Well, we are certainly pleased here at the History of WoWo.com to welcome someone who knows a lot about the station's history because he was there for it. In the old days, he was known as Alan Mitchell. Today, he's a nationally known voiceover artist, and he calls himself Al Mitchell. Now, Al, you were the program director at WoWo from when to when?
1969 to 1972. 3-year stand at good old WoWo.
And tell me a little bit about the on-air lineup at that time.
The lineup was Bob Sievers and Jay Gould, the Little Red famous Little Red Barn, from 5 to 7 a.m., and then 7 to 10, Bob Sievers went on his own. Jack Underwood was the midday guy. Let's see, Stu Collins was already there, so he was doing afternoons, and Larry Kenny at night, and Diamond Jim Brady was there also amidst this period, and I mean, he was only there a short time because he left shortly after I arrived to go to, I think, across the street to a competing station. So I only knew him for a very short time. And then all nights were Listo Fisher.
And then during the time you were there, there were a number of different nighttime guys, right?
There were a number of different nighttime guys. Larry went on to New York. That was the big change. Larry Kenny, who is a wonderful voice guy and is still doing incredible voices, character voices, and just had a wonderful, I guess, a cast of thousands in his head. And he went to New York, and so I needed to find a new nighttime guy and looked around a lot, but found a guy named Bob Del Giorno, who was in Toledo at WOHO, WOHO, and liked him and hired him. So he came in as nights, and then Listo left along the way and was replaced by Calvin Richards. And so the main changes came in the nighttime. Bob Sievers was there all the time I was there. Underwood was there all the time I was there. Stu Collins was there all the time I was there. And then those changes that we just talked about.
Were you the program director who found Earl Finkel?
Yes.
Tell us that story.
Well, that's a good question. When I was at WIND before going down to WoWo, Bob Mumy, who was the program director of WIND, had found this weatherman who worked out of Skokie, Earl Finkel, and a very, very terrific weatherman. And so Earl was doing stuff on WIND, and that's how I came to know him. And so when we went to Fort Wayne, decided everyone's very weather conscious, and especially with Bob Sievers. Sievers was just weather nut. So we put together a thing with Earl Finkel to do a number of live things from Skokie. We were WOWO, the weather station, and he was always at WOWO's weather station. We neglected to point out that that wasn't in Fort Wayne. I don't think it mattered, and it doesn't matter today.
Now, Earl did come into town occasionally.
Yes. We'd bring him in for personal appearances, and he was just very popular. And Sievers and he really hit it off together. And when you're dealing with a morning man like Bob Sievers, who was this incredible talent, just a wonderful man and had always lived in Fort Wayne and knew everyone. And you have to realize that the Little Red Barn had a 60, I think at its peak, a 67 share of the audience. And then Bob, when he went on at 7, it slipped all the way to 49%. So you're dealing with, on radio terms, with anything you mention on the Little Red Barn or in Morning Drive, half the people in this area knew about. And so Earl Finkel and Finkel Sprinkles and Bob hit it off, and Earl was an instant celebrity.
Tell us about the state of WoWo when you first got there, because it wasn't too long before that that WLIV had beaten WoWo in the ratings, right?
And I think that was part of wanting to make changes there and why I may have been sent down there. Because, yes, WLIV had cleaned their clock, and LYV was a 5,000-watt station with, I think, limited nighttime coverage. And here we were, 50,000-watt, listened to us in downtown New York City, but we couldn't win the audience there because the station was playing Ray Conniff and Perry Como.
The air check that Larry Kenny had from early 1968 had 4 songs on it. Not a single one of those songs was a top 40 hit.
No.
Which was bizarre to me when I listened to it.
The station was a true old line, middle of the road, Frankie Lane and all of that stuff. And it was a sleepy, tired station. And my job was to bring a format to it. And the challenge was, how do you update a station without jeopardizing the impact of your morning show? And so part of it for me was to really spend some time with Bob Sievers again, and because he's the key to all this, and get him comfortable with playing more rock and roll music. And there was a real internal battle because the sales department resisted this hugely. And I'm wanting to push it to not a hard rock station, but certainly, you know, play the hits. And the manager at the time was Carl Vandegrift, who saw himself as the Supreme Court. And programming, me, would come before him and make the pitch, and then the sales manager would come before him and make the pitch why this was just the stupidest thing that we could possibly ever do. And then Carl would think about it and said, we're going to do what Alan wants to do and stop complaining, go sell it. And everybody knew with Carl Vandegrift when the Supreme Court said, that's my decision, we did it. And it worked. And it worked really well, really fast. So the ratings skyrocketed, and we moved it back to a dominant position. And the dominant position means coming through the rest of the day because, again, Little Red Barn was its own thing. And people who don't know what I'm talking about, hopefully you'll be able to post on the website some of the audio tracks, and one of them is of the Little Red Barn. And this was a recreation of Bob Sievers and Jay Gould, the farm director, with sound effects, walking down to the Little Red Barn where they milked cows and fed the chickens and talked about what was going on, and Jay'd do the farm markets, and it was like nothing that even exists anymore.
They did essentially what you described for probably more than 30 years, and it really didn't change during that
time. It didn't. And that was something I didn't want to change. I mean, it was kind of like, that's sacrosanct, and you guys do the Little Red Barn. You do what you think you need to do. So,
was there anything that surprised you when you first got to the station that you weren't expecting?
Good question. I guess just two things we've kind of touched on. The amazing dominance of the station in the morning, and then how, at the time, how it fell off during the afternoon and evening hours. And beyond that, I'll have to think about that as we continue the conversation. Nothing jumps out. There was some incredible talent there with Larry Kenney and Stu Collins. I mean, I don't mean to even minimize Jack Underwood, who was an older man and was kind of the longtime midday guy, kind of the Ed McMahon to the morning show. He was the level foil. But the younger guys were very talented. They were just afraid to play current music. And if you look back, 69 through 72 was a wonderful time for top music. It was a lot of great stuff.
Let's talk about that for a minute, how you chose the music. Because even at the time you were there, there were some songs that were national hits that you still didn't play, right?
Not too many.
Did you end up day-parting a lot of those or not?
Some.
Because there were certain songs that certainly didn't fit Bob Sievers playing, for example.
Right. And my deal with Bob simply was I wanted him to play as many of the hits as he felt comfortable with. And again, had to leave it with, Bob, if it bothers you, let me know, tell me, but don't play it. And Sam DeVincent, who was the music director and also a musician, and he and his wife were the music talent on the Little Red Barn, Sam was very wonderful with Bob in saying, you want to play this. This is good stuff, because Sam liked contemporary music. And this is the era of the Carpenters and Tom Jones and Bread and the harder stuff. Now, you see, we're under the shadow of Detroit at the time. CKLW is in Detroit, pumping out Detroit Motown hits. If anything, we probably didn't play as much Motown, not as the rest of the United States, but as much as we were hearing from Detroit, because CKLW basically was a Motown station. We played a wider and perhaps a little more bland blend than Drake's CKLW.
When you added a song, did you have a weekly meeting? How did that work?
Weekly music meeting would be me, Sam DeVincent. Usually Westinghouse called them executive producers, which would be assistant PD. The assistant PD, and that changed a couple of times, but mostly it was Bob Kay, Bob Klopfenstein, who did most of the incredible production that you'll hear on some of the excerpts. And then Sam would meet the record pluggers. There were still record pluggers. And he listened to all the new stuff and would present stuff. And he tracked the charts. And we would make decisions as to what to add.
What about the jingles at that time? While you were at WoWo, you didn't buy any particular package, but you bought some individual cuts here and there, right?
We did actually custom packages because WOWO does not fit really smoothly into if you know, in the jingle business, jingle companies basically do custom packages for large radio stations and then resell them to smaller stations. We couldn't afford a complete custom package. So we actually used some of WCFL's package, re-sang those, but it did take some changes because you're getting in more syllables.
Mm-hmm.
WCFL, WOWO, and we did a lot more stuff. But we did two different packages. Actually, I have to tell a story about that, and I hope that I could find it. And I know I have it, but I still haven't found it. I went down for the first time to do jingles at TM Productions in Dallas, and we had this incredible jingle production. But I had been offered somehow this cheap jingle package, like for $100, was 30 custom jingles, and it was one guy doubling himself. And I bought them and then had them customized to Bobo and all of the talent. And so the big meeting in the studio was to introduce all the guys to the new jingle package. And I played this $100 package. And I wish I had movies of the faces of just incredulousness to this awful jingle package. It was wonderful. And then I played them the actual jingles, which probably paved the way to them thinking those were the greatest jingles ever. And there's another little story about WOWO that I want to tell, because when I came there, it was not WOWO. It was always WOWO 1190, the 50,000-watt voice of Fort Wayne, Indiana, WOWO, Fort Wayne. And everyone in town called it WOWO, but it was standard operating procedure not to do that. The people at the station thought it's kind of silly, and it was kind of like, let's just be WOWO. And once again, that turned into a wonderful advantage for the station. There's two things that helped cement that. One was a salesman at the time, Dick Miller, said, you know, She's a Lady was the number one song, Tom Jones. She's a lady, whoa, 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 she's a lady. And he said, there's a lot of whoa-whoas in the songs. You ought to do a contest with them. Like, I never thought of that. And so we did a contest called WOWO Music, when we took the whoa-whoas out of 21 songs and made a montage, and the contest was based around, if you can identify all 21, you'd win a car. I mean, a drawing from all the correct answers. Well, this really worked well to the point that WLYV and the other middle-of-the-road station had to drop all the WOWO songs from their playlist because the line we used was so popular they even sing about us.
Oh, that's funny.
In the popular songs. And so there were a lot of them that were popular at the time with WOWOs.
What year was that contest first run? Do you remember?
I think it was 69, 70. It was right in there.
Because it was run a number of times
later years. It came back a number of times in a number of incarnations. And then the other one that went with this is, I think, one of the greatest contests of all times, and it was somebody else's suggestion. It was one of the sales guys who also then worked for General Telephone. We did a Christmas promotion, ho, ho, wo, wo. If a payphone rings next to you, answer it, but don't say hello, say ho, ho, wo, wo, and you'll win a ham. Now, there was some question at the time because of Westinghouse's legal department about how can you make calls live on the air, these people haven't given their permission. And we made the case at the time that they have indeed given their permission by saying, ho, ho, whoa, whoa. That implies permission that we could talk to them. If they say hello, we'll take them off the air. And the legal department, probably foolishly, agreed to that. So we did this whole Christmas promotion, and so we would spot all of these pay telephones and go watch them because we knew that at 1:15 we were going to call that phone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this turned into melees at shopping centers with hundreds of people. A phone would ring and hundreds of people are clamoring and fighting each other to get to the phone to say, ho, ho, whoa, whoa. And then because General Telephone, the AT&T down there at the time, kind of said, well, we don't know if we like this. And we said, well, this would be a public service, thinking fast, because then we would locate all of the out-of-service payphones. Oh, well, good. So we ran public service announcements for General Telephone saying, if you find a payphone that's not working, make sure you let us know so we can call it. And in 1969, this was big stuff. That combination of two things made WOWO just a household name, and the only time it was ever referred to as WOWO after that was in jingles and at the top of the hour.
That's a great story. I want to ask about some of the other promotions at the station at that time, and if we forget some, please bring them up. But the WOWO kite flight, that was started under your leadership?
Yes. That actually began at WIND in Chicago, WIND, Wind for the Windy City. And I don't have any credit for creating the initial kite fly in Chicago, but it was done in Grant Park, and it was usually done in the spring and contests, and each of the personalities would make a kite and the whole thing. And so when I went to Fort Wayne, I thought, this is a perfect thing to do. And then it tied in with Earl Finkel. Earl would be there. Yeah. You could meet Earl Finkel, and that's how the kite fly came to be. And likewise, there was a promotion at the zoo, very similar to Zoo Day in Chicago. Now, I was involved deeply in that one because I've always been a big zoo fan and knew the head of Lincoln Park Zoo at the time and said, we'd love to do this and invite everybody out, and it would be a great promotion for you. And they said, it would be wonderful. And so it worked so well there that we also started the Zoo Day in Fort Wayne as well.
How about WOWO Ski Lift? Was that started around that time?
I think that came after me. The one that comes to mind, though, that I would mention is the WOWO Aces.
That was on my list.
Yeah, because I came there, and this WOWO Aces was ostensibly the WOWO basketball team that would play local schools. And when I came there, there were a lot of ringers on the team, and they played real basketball. And most of the personalities were not good enough, including me, and I wasn't a personality, but not a ball player. And so I looked at this and at the same time had just gone to a Harlem Globetrotters event and thought, we ought to make this entertainment, not see if your faculty can humiliate our air personalities on the floor in front of your high school kids. And so we had several big meetings saying, what can we do? And the first thing that occurred to us was bring our own ref, because that was also part of the problem. The referees were always on their side. So we would bring our own ref. And then the other one was the locker room talk. We came up with all these little shticks that we eventually did, covering the basket with a trash lid. And just we stole a lot from the Harlem Globetrotters. But I would go over to visit the other locker room ahead of time and say, I need to understand kind of what we're doing here. We're not here to play basketball with you. We're here to entertain these people. So what we're going to do is, if you will go along with this, we can have a lot of fun. We'll pull lots of silly stuff, and we won't make fun of you, and I mean, we won't put you down in any way. And let's just do this show to like the last 3 minutes, and let's keep it within 10 points to the last 3 minutes, and then play ball. And if you beat us in the last 3 minutes, we'll put our ringers in. We'll play you guys. Most of the time that worked well. There were still a few that wanted to do it, but with our own ref, we could at least control the pace of the game, and we had enough shtick that if they started to get heated or trying to really show us up, we'd just do some silly thing with, you know, throwing buckets of confetti into the, you know, the old water gag where it ends up being a bucket of confetti. And we were able to throw it off enough that pretty soon everybody got onto this, that this is really a good deal. And then for the ensuing time, we really had a really nice show. We had a lot of fun and did a lot of silliness, met a lot of people, and it was really a good thing. So that was the WOWO Aces.
Any other promotions that you can think of that were really memorable to you?
One of the more interesting ones, because it is so anachronistic, was the release of Jesus Christ Superstar. About 1969, about 1970, out came this double album set. Mm-hmm. Fort Wayne is in the middle of the Bible Belt, and we started playing some of the things from Jesus Christ Superstar and immediately got hit with more conservative evangelical religious people complaining bitterly, to the point that they were complaining to sponsors. I mean, this was a big deal. Remember, this is 40 years ago. And it was like, I need to do something about this. And I attended the Methodist church there, and there was a Lycurgus Starkey was the minister and a really terrific contemporary guy. And it finally occurred to us, and we said, would you do an annotated version if we played the entire thing and you would come in and explain the biblical basis of each of the tracks, would you do that? He said, I'd love to do that. And so with his promotion, there's a promo for it that it talks, is his voice saying, the scripture says, new wine in new wineskins, and this is a new wineskin, and proceeded then to show the biblical basis of the entire Jesus Christ superstar. And everything evaporated in terms of the complaints, and everybody decided that we indeed were a good Christian radio station. And I just tell the story because it was quite fascinating how today we would say, what? That was a problem? Yes, in 1969, 1970, this was a huge problem. And it was just a very creative way of solving it. And so while not a promotion, it was a very big thing at the time because we played several times. We played the whole work. So it was like 2.5 hour broadcast with a minister's comments in between. So I think of that fondly.
Do you have any favorite Bob Sievers stories? I'm sure there are a lot of them, but what comes to mind when you think of Bob?
Well, first of all, Bob was just a wonderful, jolly, happy man who had grown up in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and was now the morning man on this radio station, and everybody knew him, and he was just one of the great guys of all time. And we developed a nice relationship, part of it being, as I mentioned earlier, having understanding that he's the key to all of this, and he has to be happy with what we're doing, and I have to give him reasons why we're trying to do what we're doing, because if he doesn't go along with it, nothing happens. Now, Bob was also, and I don't want to use the word naive, because he was easily led down the primrose path. And Jay Gould, the farm director, was a little rapscallion who loved to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And on one of the promos, they had set him up to make some return phone calls to Mr. G. Raff and things like that, that people had been – G. Raff had called, and they called, and he kept returning these phone calls and get the numbers not in service. And he then started to make this big bit on the air about this, and he was so frustrated. And what's going on is he's forgotten that this is April 1st. April Fool's Day, and people are calling the radio station. We're having to screen all the calls, and he's aware that no one's calling in and that people usually call in. He didn't understand that, and the news guys are off in the corner just laughing heartily, and they're trying to hide all this. And so Bob naively keeps going, keeps working this thing until it's finally revealed that to find out about the circus, and he's calling the Fort Wayne Zoo for Mr. G. Raff, and it finally occurs to him he's been taken. And you will hear, if you listen to the piece, his reactions, which are just priceless, about the laughter of how he was taken. And so this was typical of many of the things that Bob would do, and it's just wonderful.
Bob was the same person off the air than he was on the air.
Very much so. No change to the guy at all. And actually would talk about his personal life and things that were going on. And you have the picture of – you'd asked me before we went on the interview about what's this picture of a bird that says Winston. And this was a baby robin that had somehow fallen out of the nest, and Bob raised it. And so that became the Daily Winston report on – the morning show about how he was feeding it, and people are calling in, and just everybody's getting involved in this because Bob just would relate everything that was going on in his life on the air. And it was just magic, and he was wonderful and a great man, great man.
All right, now you have a great story about going to the WoWo transmitter, so tell us that one.
When I arrived at WoWo, I couldn't understand why, when you listened on the radio, WLYV, this 500 or 1,000-watt station, was louder than we were. And it was like, I don't get this. And I asked, the general manager, I asked a lot of people, what's happening with all this? And they, well, I don't know. Just, you know, that's kind of the way it works. So I drove out to the transmitter one day. And I can't remember the guy's name. I'll think of it in a minute. But older guy who just kind of sat there in his chair.
Homer Evans.
And he's, you got it. And he's supervising what looks like something right out of the old Frankenstein movies. This 50,000-watt thing that's glowing and humming and the whole needles. And he's just kind of watching it. And I introduced myself and had some nice conversation and so forth. And I said, you know, Homer, one of the things I don't understand is why this isn't as loud as WLYV. Oh, well, it could be. And he reaches over, and there's a big pot on the wall, and he turns this thing, boom, and the needles all swing to the right. The tubes start glowing purple. There's this boom, sound, and the sound level goes up 30%. He said, but we don't run it that way because it costs too much for the power. And so I thanked him, and I went back, and Carl Vandegrift, the general manager, and said to him, are we really trying to save some electricity here, or could we tell Homer to turn it up and blow the dust out? And he said, we'll tell Homer to turn it up. So Homer got the word, and we were running like 80% modulation. You can run 125%. You can overmodulate a radio station. So anyway, we told Homer, turn the pot up.
Boom.
And from then on, the 50,000-watt voice of Fort Wayne actually sounded like 50,000 watts. And our power bills went up, I'm sure.
Did you put the reverb on the station, or was that later?
I did not. We did not do that, but we brought in a guy I had worked with in Minneapolis named John Tollefson as chief engineer, who went on to a nice career in Westinghouse and then on in Washington, D.C. But we did a lot of signal processing that nobody was doing at the time. We played with the audio curve, kind of created a loudness curve, replaced a bunch of crappy microphones with Telefunken U47s, which is the recording standard microphone for an AM radio station. We goosed that baby just about as high as you could, but we didn't do reverb. Hadn't thought of that probably yet.
You went on to quite a few legendary stations, a lot of Group W stations. Tell us about that a little bit and what you took from WoWo to those stations.
Well, WoWo was the training ground certainly for me. I mean, I'd learned a lot from Bob Mumy at WIND, the man I'd worked under in the late 60s. But this was a chance to really – Westinghouse used WOWO as their kind of training ground, and they would pick off people. Many of the people who were there went on to, including Chris Whitting. Just a lot of people that went on from their experiences there to great success in Westinghouse broadcasting. And so I just got to do a lot of things that you couldn't do. And as we talked before, having the impact of the morning share that we had, so that all you had to do is mention it once at 7:15 in the morning and half the town knew about it. And I went to KDKA in Pittsburgh, which was a similar situation where you had a morning show guy, Jack Bogut, and great influence in the community. So it was a similar situation. 13Q, KQV, was Buzz Bennett, the famous Buzzy Bennett was a program director who had been at KGB in San Diego and was probably one of the people who first pioneered like the 15-song playlist. He would come into a town and with huge promotion and giving away $1,000 an hour, which again in the 70s, big money, usually just wiped out all the competition and would go from zero to 40 and 50% shares in large markets. And he was coming to town. So the challenge at KDKA was the same way. Get it more contemporary. Do things that would have some impact and stave off, hopefully, the invasion of 13Q. And we did a lot of wonderful things there, various promotions. Again, with a morning man who was just very happy, Jack Bogut, who was very happy to cooperate with all of this stuff. And I think one of the highlights of my radio career was meeting Buzz Bennett after the rating books came out. And they went from a 5 to a 24 share in one book. And we went from a 22 to a 27 in the same book. And I got to met him at a media get-together, and he came up to me and he said, you're the program director, right, KDK? I said, yes. Great to meet you. We had a nice little conversation. He said, no one's ever beaten me like that before. Congratulations. He said, no one's ever done that to me. I said, thank you. It was fun. And so.
And then later when you were at WIND, you stole Stu Collins, didn't you, from WoWo?
I stole both Bob Dell, who used the air name Bob Dell in Fort Wayne, but then returned to his real name, Bob Del Giorno, at WIND, and Stu brought them both up, and Bob Klopfenstein. So I brought him in as production director. So yes, Fort Wayne, we brought a number of people up from Fort Wayne.
How much interaction was there between the program directors of the Group W stations, or at least programming personnel like that?
Quite a bit. At the time, Westinghouse owned the seven stations that it could own. You could only own seven radio stations. And three of them were all news, and so had very little contact with the all news guys. But four of them, WIND, WBZ, Boston, KDKA, Pittsburgh, and then Fort Wayne. And so we all talked to each other quite a bit, and if something worked real well, we would translate it to the other town.
Is it true that you saw Buddy Holly's final live performance?
Yes. I have two claims to rock and roll history, and that's the first one, which was in 1959, I was a junior in high school in a little town called Thompson, Iowa. My mother had remarried. We lived in Chicago, and we moved to this little northern Iowa town. And the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake, Iowa, had all of these cavalcades of stars or winter dance parties and all of this. And one was coming that was called Winter Dance Party, Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper, Dion and the Belmonts, Richie Valens, and Frankie Sardo. And just happened to be there. And I was dating a girl named Donna. And Richie Valens' hit was, Oh, Donna. Mm-hmm. So we had to go. And I loved Buddy Holly. So we stood 20 feet from the stage, saw that concert, and thought nothing of it until the next morning, which was then immortalized by Don McLean's American Pie song, Bad News on the Doorstep, I Couldn't Take One More Step, and found out that he had died, and no one believed it in high school, and it was much gnashing of teeth and crying and terrible thing. And had the honor this year, last February was the 50th anniversary of that. They invited me back. I got to be on a panel. I've since befriended Bob Hale. He's a Chicago guy who was a disc jockey here, actually worked for me part-time at WIND. But Bob Hale was the MC that night, so got to kind of relive it. And Donna came back also. She lives in Minnesota, and she was there. And so we kind of got to recreate the moment, and it was almost like time travel. We're standing there on the floor about where we stood, and there was a very good tribute band who was recreating it, and it was like, wow, is this 2009 or 1959? I'm not sure. So yeah, that was a very big moment that I didn't count on. The other story that I will mention is I was, before coming to WIND, I worked in Minneapolis, and I was a music director and a disc jockey at a small station there, KQRS, suburban Golden Valley. And I was listening to an album one night at home, just listening to new stuff, and we were kind of a middle-of-the-road station, and heard this song I liked, instrumental, and I kept listening to it, and it was like, wow, this is catchy. This is really great. We started playing it on the radio, and people started calling and saying, what is that? And then the record distributor called and said, what are you playing? Because we're selling out of this album. And it was by a French composer named Paul Moriart, and the song was entitled Love is Blue. And I said, it's just going over. They released it as a single about the time I moved to Chicago. And WIND's studios, in fact, are across the river at that time in the Wrigley Building from Mercury Phillips, the record label. They released it as a single. Of course, it became this massive worldwide phenomenon. Paul came to Orchestra Hall, introduced me there as the Minneapolis disc jockey that discovered Love is Blue. And so he's become an international star. I did correspond with him for a long time, kind of lost touch now. But those are my two claims to real rock and roll immortality.
Those are great stories.
Well, thanks for asking, Bud.
Well, Al, just to put a bow on all this, if you look back at your time at WoWo, what would you say the keys were to the success of the radio station? Because it was such a dominant station in its time.
Personality. And I think anybody who's been around radio for an awfully long time laments what has in some ways happened to radio. There's still vestiges of it. It's just a personality, somebody who's on the air, and it's not packaged and it's not contrived and it's local and they're talking about local places and they have a real spark to them. And all Bob Sievers and Jack Underwood and Stu Collins and Larry Kenny and Bob Del Giorno and all these guys, Listo and Calvin, they all had this, they were real people. And they let it out on the radio. And I guess I'm one of those guys who kind of laments that we've packaged it, music radio, now to the point where it's just pretty homogenized. It doesn't have that same. There's not somebody saying something, not necessarily outrageous, because none of these guys were shock jocks. None of these guys were, you know, pushing any limits. They were just really nice people on the radio, and people liked to listen to them. And then a lot of promotion, a lot of just fun, and it was all meant to be fun. Can we do something? What else silly can we do? And so it was a time of great laughter and silliness and guys who didn't really know what we were doing, just kind of making it up and saying, oh, you want to try that? Yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do that. And we did.
Well, Al, thank you so much for spending time with us here.
You're welcome, Randy. This is great. It's fun to remember all these memories.